This is the Packet Pushers podcast, the greatest data networking podcast in the world. And today we're talking about some user stories. We've had one of our members of the audience pipe up and say, we should talk about what I'm doing. So we said, yes. I'm Greg Farrow. With me today is Ethan Banks, and this is the Packet Pushers podcast. Let's just go straight into the show and talk to our guest. Jamie, please introduce yourself to the audience.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jamie Wilson. I'm a network specialist, and I work for Live Nation in the UK.
And Live Nation is famous for what?
Live music.
Live music? But people dancing up and down on a stage.
Pretty much.
Bouncing
pretty pretty much. So Live Nation is the world's largest organization that deals and manages live music.
So basically, what you said to me was that you set up these networks for gigs.
Now,
is that festivals or concerts or what?
So predominantly we work within the festival IT division in the UK, and it is festivals that we focus our attention on. So these are some small, but some very large festivals here in the UK.
So I'm actually 50,000, 20,000.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, literally, I'm sitting here now in the boiler room at Donington Park, which is the spiritual home of rock. And we are just getting ready for the deployment for the Download Festival. So this is the first day on site for us.
Right.
So it's a bit like moving house. We're just getting set up. We're just moving our equipment in. But obviously, we're prioritizing getting the coffee machine up.
Coffee machine first, Wi-Fi second. Is that
absolutely? No, I actually did it the other way around today. I did actually bring up what we class as one of our sort of core, like our mini infrastructures, to bring up some hotspot connectivity, right. And then we plug the coffee machine in.
So a festival for what is a cultural thing in Europe. For the people who don't know, who are listening from around the world, let me just give you some cultural relevance. In the UK, in the summertime, promoters will promote an event and basically put a stage up in the middle of a big paddock and then sell tickets and camping, and there'll be parking all around it. And I'm talking massive ones, like Glastonbury Festival is one of the biggest, where the total attendance is like 120,000 people in a paddock, literally in a farm, with their tents and their cars and everything associated with it. And these things go on through the summer. There's about 50 to 100 of them. I've got no idea how many there is. And Live Nation is the biggest provider of these in the UK. And they literally run for days. Like the main stage will run from 10 in the morning until 2 in the morning. Is that about right?
But yeah, about right. Yeah, absolutely. It depends on the type of music that's on and obviously the license that's applied to the site for the live music. But yeah, these things run sort of depending on the site. If they've got camping, the campsite might open on the Wednesday lunchtime and it won't shut down again until Monday or Tuesday. So these events run for a significant amount of time.
I've done several of these and they're hugely good fun, although my best days for festival going it might be behind me. Do you wear the crazy hat? Normally when you go to festival, you wear a crazy hat or a stupid shirt, or do you wear something more conventional?
What you do is you do your hair for the first couple of days and then you give up, and that's when you put the hat on. It really does depend on the weather, of course. You know, if you're a drowned rat because it's been raining for 4 days, you need a hat. Definitely need a hat.
So how do you build a network in a paddock? Literally, like these things are just paddocks. And you're talking about they build the stages, they build it. How do you build a network in that environment?
It's a challenge. I came into Live Nation about 14, 15 months ago, specifically to design this network. Mm. I came in, sat down with the festival IT team, and we worked out what was good and what was bad, and effectively built a solution that could come online bit by bit. If a site's being built, then it might be that actually the areas that you need to service are not there. We literally turn up in a green field, you know, and, you know, it puts a new meaning to the green field. Obviously, it's been raining, it's a brown field, but,
you know, it takes a couple of days to turn into a brown field.
Absolutely. It really does depend. You know, touch wood, the weather here is pretty good at the moment. And that can have its, you know, issues, of course, as well. You know, sunburn comes to mind. So what will happen?
Network engineers who get sunburned. That's just outrageous.
Absolutely. You have to stock up on your sun cream before you start the event. I learned that the hard way last year, you know.
Oh,
best advice I got last year was wear shorts. And I was like, well, why would I want to wear shorts, you know, if it's raining? And they said, well, you can wash your legs. It's a bit more difficult to constantly wash your jeans and your trousers. And it's a pretty good piece of advice until we were.
I learned to take to festivals. There's a type of trousers, and they're made out of like a nylon-y type of material. They're like a man-made material, and the legs can zip off. So when you're cold, you can zip the legs on, and when you want to wash them, you just duck them in, wash them under a tap, and it all washes out near enough.
I'm not sure I'm old enough for those trousers yet, Greg. Well, you walk straight into that one.
I was about to admit that I wear those in the woods hiking almost every weekend, but now I'm not going to admit that at all.
So you're literally saying you move into a paddock, and then you're saying the first thing is that most of the site is actually not there yet, so you can't lay out the Wi-Fi.
Absolutely.
So are you using Wi-Fi? Are you using cable? So let's start with the basics. Are you cabling or using Wi-Fi?
Both. So one of the biggest challenges and one of the biggest reasons for coming in last year to join Live Nation was the stability of the networks that were being deployed on sites. So historically, they were outsourced to contractors, and you know, depending on the organization, they'd have their own sort of topology. We came in, obviously, and sat down and said, well, what works and what doesn't? And one of the issues was backbone stability. So a huge amount of our infrastructure is fiber. And that's because we want to make sure that our backbone is stable and that we're not being affected by 100,000 people rocking up and taking out a particular part of the
wireless. So when you say backbone, what do you mean?
In terms of our topology, we actually, everything that we do is built, pre-built. So before we come to site, it's all pre-built in our warehouse, predominantly by myself and the team around me. So I've got some really good guys working with me. So we work and we build in our warehouse, and we test. You know, we thoroughly test this kit. Mm-hmm. It's all racked. It all gets delivered to site pre-wired in flight cases. So our core network is in a flight case. We can wheel it into the room that we're going to take our backhaul connectivity from, put the backhaul in, turn the UPSs on, and 5 minutes later, our core network's up and operational.
So when you say core network, what are you talking about? You're talking about an internet connection or an internet router?
What I'm talking about here is we'll take an internet connection, we'll terminate that within our DMZ. Mm-hmm. From that, we'll then take our firewalls and routed infrastructure. Mm-hmm. We'll bring that into what I guess a collapsed core type Cisco solution. Mm-hmm. And from there, we'll then actually distribute and what I kind of class as our backbone then. So our core network will be, I could say, operational pretty much from day one.
So you get an internet, so you get a hard line to the internet, is what
we're
saying.
We get a mixture, to be honest. Believe it, it really does depend on the site. You know, some sites have great connectivity, some don't. Mm-hmm. It really does come down to the site and the physical location. Some, like I say, some sites we can bring in gigabit circuits. Other sites we can't.
So what do you do then? Do you use like a bunch of mobile LTE 3Gs and then use modems to multiplex them together, or do you bring in a satellite dish?
Bit of both, really. I'm not particularly keen on the satellite solution. You know yourself, you know, as requirements increase on the network in terms of bandwidth requirements, the satellite can be good, but it's not the kind of solution that we would want to be relying on. It's great as a sort of a backup, but it certainly isn't something that I would want to have as part of my core incoming connectivity.
So site might have a hard line, so you're saying you'd be able to get a carrier to come and install a circuit of some sort?
Yeah, pretty much. Depending on whether or not the festival organizer has, you know, signed a contract with BT or whoever that, you know, the local provider is, will dictate what we have to play with. Mm. When we were at Tech Unplugged, and I spoke to you and asked you about channel bonding, that was on the basis that sometimes I can turn up at site and I might have a 3 meg ADSL connection. I might have a satellite link. I might have a 50 meg microwave circuit. But I might have requirements on site for 100, 200, 300 megabits per second, full sync.
Yeah. So there are devices you can buy which will let you load balance, do directed stuff, and low cost ones, right? This isn't, you're not talking about routers or traditional routers or anything like that. There are devices you can buy that will load balance across multiple internet connections, and you can low weight them across.
You can, yes.
Cradlepoint is one. And there's about, I think there's five or six of them. I'd have to go and get my documentation out to check it up.
Yeah, there's quite a few. Draytech, Peplink, I think, also do sort of a similar kind of product. The issue I found with load balanced routers is that they still don't necessarily fix the issue. because you might have a 3 meg circuit, but you have a requirement on site for a client who wants a 15 meg circuit. And you, well, yep. I can't use that link now. There's no point load balancing down something that's not sufficient. We've started to look at products that actually do channel bonding. So put all the bandwidth together, make a big fat pipe into a data center somewhere, and have it all come out as one big, you know, as one link essentially, and do the same thing. And we found that as a great way of bringing in a large amount of bandwidth to site without the need to send one person down one route, one person down another route. There are products out there that are particularly clever, very clever, in fact, that can send it all on different links, put it all back together, and you get the bandwidth that you need.
I guess what you're saying is there that users are always doing something new or different. So whatever profile you set up to share the bandwidth out in a certain way all of a sudden gets bypassed because there's always some fool who wants to watch Netflix at a festival or something.
Absolutely, you know, and we could filter that kind of content out, but I don't want to do that. You come to one of our sites, right? I want you to have that network, and I want it to be stable.
And I want incredibly it to be nice. I hate my users. I'd make their lives miserable.
It'd be a lot easier. But that's kind of our approach. You know, we're an internal resource. We work for Live Nation, so we have a vested interest. We're all music lovers. We all care about the festival. We want it to be good, and we want people who are on site to have the connectivity that they require to do their jobs. Because there's nothing more frustrating than not being able to do your job because the network's down, especially in a field.
Especially if everything's been set up around
your options are limited.
We are taking a short break from the show to talk about one of today's sponsors, Micronics Training. I can talk about Micronics not just because they are a sponsor, but because I am a Micronics customer. In fact, I have attended multiple CCIE routing and switching boot camps with Micronics over the years with instructor Narbik Kacharians. One boot camp was just before I passed my CCIE routing and switching lab back in 2008, and the most recent one was in the fall of 2015. Micronics boot camps are the real deal. You get detailed workbooks that show you not only what to do, but also the most important part of networking, verifying that what you've configured is working right. You also get live lectures from top-notch instructors. For example, Narbik's lectures are legendary among those of us that have sat in them. He wastes no words while still clearly explaining topics that might have frustrated you before. And you will not see a PowerPoint. It is all whiteboard. It's sort of like being Neo in the Matrix. You leave the lecture feeling like network foo was uploaded directly to your brain. These boot camps aren't just workbooks and lecture, though. You also get time to work on equipment configuration with even more labs designed to teach specific concepts. These boot camps are, if I'm honest, really tough, because if you do everything that's expected of you, your boot camp days will be some of the longest, but most rewarding, 5 or 10 days that you can spend. Which reminds me, Micronics offers several CCIE-level boot camps, including routing and switching, security, data center, and service provider. Some of them are 5 days, some of them are 10 days, and if you're not working on a CCIE certification, Micronics offers instruction in several other courses, including CCNA, CCNP, DCICN, CCDE, and more. So to learn from the best, head over to MicronicsTraining.com. Micronics is an authorized Cisco Learning Partner, and they accept Cisco Learning Credits. One more time, that's MicronicsTraining.com. And please, when you sign up for a course or a boot camp, let them know that Packet Pushers sent you.
So you've got a microwave link, or you've got a hard line. You've got some internet bandwidth of some sort. You've probably got several different types. Do you use any LTE or mobile phone bandwidths?
Absolutely. So we'll edge our bets and we'll go across all providers at this site. Particularly, we'll bring in multiple different SIM cards from multiple different vendors. Yeah. So we use a VipriNet is a product that we use, and I've been very impressed with that product. And we can put up to 6 modules into one of their rack-mounted chassis and bond together the 6 SIM cards if we want to. And that gives us, I wouldn't necessarily say that we could run the entire site from it. Mm. Again, when 100,000 people turn up, you tend to lose your LTE connectivity. Your 3G kind of drops off.
I guess, that's the other side of it, is when you get 20,000 people, 50,000 people, the actual spectrum gets incredibly congested.
It does. And that happens with the wireless spectrum also. So, radio frequency spectrum, when we're running sort of our wireless links, it's great if you're next to the AP, not so good if you're, 100 meters away from it. So that's part of the reason.
What's the network used for? What does the network do? So is it for the administration, the business side?
it actually does a lot. So we will run multiple services on our network. We all run sponsorship networks. We will run the artist networks. So the guys who come to site, you know, the big name artists, they'll rock up with their touring crew. They'll require internet connectivity. We'll build that network for them. We'll give them that connectivity. We give the connectivity to our production crews. The press, when they come in, they obviously need a really quick connection as well. So we'll provide a network for them so they can upload and download and the content can come out quickly. We have a lot of streaming services that obviously require a huge amount of bandwidth. We'll service those guys as well. In addition to that,
live streaming the concert or something like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's festivals that we did last year where you could log in online and watch the festival for free on a major website, and that content was coming across our network for a portion. Certainly bringing it, you know, into the once we hit the internet.
Yes, that was the feed. You pushed the feed out to head office then.
Absolutely, absolutely. But then, of course, we work with the blue light services that are on site. We work with the local authorities. At the end of the day, these festivals are spun up in certain locations, and they're based on having a license. You know, we have to make sure that we adhere to certain policies, that the music stops at a certain time, etc., etc. Those individuals are on site. I would say the jewel in our crown, if you like, is our sort of IP CCTV platform. So we run all of the security CCTV on site, and that does require quite a bit of bandwidth.
So you're servicing the company's employees. You have a bunch of partners, business partners associated, and you're saying not just sponsors and guests and band members and that type of stuff. You're also talking about emergency services and council,
yes.
The councils who gave the approval to use the land and had to you know, do all the load. So they're all sharing that network as well so that they can get their jobs done.
Correct.
And then you're talking about these IP cameras as well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I love IP cameras. I did them. Last time I did them was years ago.
Yeah, they're pretty good, these ones are, actually. They're 1080p. They're fabulous. Once we're all set up, you know, within our event control space, and you've got your, you know, your 100, 200-inch TV video wall set up, and you've got these cameras everywhere on site, it's absolutely fabulous. What you see and what you can see through it is very good.
So how do the cameras connect to the network? We've just said that the Wi-Fi is a problem because of the, you know, you get so many people congested. They've got, I guess, because their mobile phones are overloading the spectrum.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, absolutely. You get sort of, you know, you get areas of congestion, particularly in the sort of the campsite areas where everybody's camping, obviously. Mm. Yeah, those kind of areas are very difficult and notorious for bringing in wireless connectivity. So once we've built our core network, you know, we might actually break into the on-site fiber rings if they exist, and then what we'll do is fiber out what we class as our distribution cabinets, and from there we can take our edge connectivity. So pretty much what we do.
So does that mean you actually dig trenches and lay cable into the trenches, or you try and use what's on the site?
It's a bit of both. A bit of both. Again, it's when we sit down sort of pre-season. So our season runs from sort of May through to September. So our off-season is October onwards. We'll sit down with the site plans. We'll understand what we already know. You know, maybe a site's made an investment. The sites are not necessarily owned by the company. They might be rented. So the infrastructure that's on site can change year on year, depending on obviously what's happened locally. So we'll look at what's available to us, and we'll work out what our topology is going to look like, where we'll be able to break in and utilize underground fibers, and where we can't.
What do you mean by underground fibers? I don't understand that.
As in, like, I'll give you an example here. We're at Donington Circuit. We've got fiber under the racetrack, which goes from one side of the arena to the other side. So we'll be able to actually go in. Yeah. So
That's already there. They built it as part of the...
It's already there, yeah. Or over the years, it's been paid, you know, people have paid to invest in that, to have that fiber link between, you know, section A and section B. And that might be single mode, it might be multi-mode, depending on who installed it.
So you have boxes of transceivers and cables and of every single type, I'm guessing.
Pretty much, but our core infrastructure never changes.
No,
we might retag a few edge ports, you know, here and there, but fundamentally, what comes out of our warehouse is fit for purpose when we get...
No, I'm thinking if you're connecting to that fiber, you don't know whether it's multi-mode or single mode, whether it's SCST, LC, you'll have a bag.
Absolutely. It's the one thing we get through quite a few. Yeah, absolutely. It depends. It really does depend. I mean, obviously, the more you do it, the more you work on that particular site, the more familiar you get with the fiber runs that are available to you.
Mm-hmm.
When that's not an option, then we use our own fiber. and we deploy, or we use redeployable fiber. So it's quite expensive, but you can reuse it, and you can use it again and again and again. And we'll use single mode fiber, 200 to 250 meters per reel, and we'll go in whatever direction we need to service our...
2 kilometers max, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I'll give you a few statistics, actually. One of the events that we did last season, we actually put in... this was one of our sort of mid-range events. We put in 12 and a half kilometers of redeployable fiber at that event.
Wow.
So I'll give you an idea. That was 62 reels of fiber that we used. And, you know, we've got those 62 reels are now here. So, you know, you pay once, you use them 14 times.
So redeployable fiber. So this is a special type of fiber with some sort of connector system attached to it? Is it?
Yes.
Can I just search it up on the internet and I'll find it?
Yeah, it's. I couldn't tell you what brand it is, actually. I've forgotten.
It's hardly important. I'm just checking, like, the name of it is redeployable fiber. I've just never heard of that.
It's military. Well, I say it's military grade. I think it stems originally from the military in their, you know, in their requirement to be able to reel it in and reel it back.
Well, there, look at that. It comes on reels, and it has snap lock connectors and waterproof cases, and wow.
It's very good, you know, for what we need. It's indispensable, really. It comes with LC connectors on the end, and obviously, you know, if you need to go further than 200 meters because it's single mode, you can join there. Put a junction box on them in the middle. Make sure it's watertight.
So where do the junction boxes go? On a pole in the ground? On a something?
It does come down to the site. It comes down to, you know, is it a public area or not a public area? If it's a public area, it'll go up on a 21-foot pole. If it's not, and it's a secure area, then it'll be based on the ground.
Yeah. So backstage.
Yes.
Or walkways where it's restricted for the they create walkways at the fences, fenced off areas.
They basically. Do, yes.
Jamie, can I ask you about some logistics of some of the stages that are at these festivals? So yeah, I come at it from a viewpoint of someone who sees them on TV, like Brixton or some of the other festivals like that. I see huge acts up there. You know, Metallica's up there. They got the big screens behind them, which we talked about a little bit before, and so on and so on. How much of that is you, Live Nation, and how much of that is Metallica with the big truck you said that wheels up and so on?
Honestly, it does depend on the actual act that's actually participating. I know that the actual stage that's coming in is part of the festival cost, but actually some artists will bring their own stages and insist that stage is the one that's used. The stage itself, you know, that can take a week to 10 days to actually construct.
Oh, I know, so, I know. Packer Pushers is like that. Sorry. Like hell.
So when they come in and bring their own stage, then that means it's their own stage, but then it's all their own effects. Is it their own video screens then too, their sound wall for the live reinforcement and so on?
It is, yes. It can be. We have organizations that we partner with that actually come to site, that actually do all the video screens. They be in conjunction with the stage management crew and the actual riggers, if you like, you know, the stage kind of crew that come to site. So it's a real mixed bag, actually. It's a real team effort. You know, that stage does not come from one particular person. It comes from a group of individuals all working together to bring that online.
And then they're going to interface with you for site internet connectivity or whatever it is they're looking for. So is there like some kind of a big meeting where you're going to, okay, Metallica's massive stage crew, let's figure out how to plug you guys in?
Yeah, absolutely. What we do is we take our requirements up front. But obviously we have to be able to react once new requirements come in. When we sat down to build the network originally, it had to be flexible, and we had to be able to react quickly to change without actually jeopardizing the rest of the network, of course. that was the biggest challenge for me personally, was to build a network that could be bought online in stages with no risk to the rest of the network.
Yeah, because when you first get in, there's nothing there. And then stuff gets built in the 2 weeks ahead, like the restricted areas, the stage, the cook areas, there's accommodation for certain people and stuff like that.
Correct.
So I guess you start with the core, and then there's people on site, but you're still, I guess, first through the door, I suppose.
Yeah, pretty much. We get a schedule come through. We know who's on site, when they're on site, and we know the dates that they require their connectivity.
It sounds like a huge campus network, basically. You're building it in big segments as different parts of the festival move in.
Absolutely.
So, is that then hub and spoke? Because you've been talking about fiber, like maybe there's a ring topology there, actually.
Without kind of giving it away too much. And the reason I say that, the topology is unique. I don't know anybody that's doing this.
As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. It's kind of hard to see what you don't own, and that becomes a big problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services on outsourced infrastructure. Figuring out what's gone wrong and who's responsible can take hours, and in some cases, weeks. And what about planning ahead to avoid those issues in the first place? So that brings us to our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. Your corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider network, all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. Together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. Again, the networks you own and the networks that you don't. So let's consider this. How does all of this data from ThousandEyes help you out? And there's really three things you should consider. One, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight, from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance. In other words, you can tell what's going on in the internet BGP routing tables and how DNS is resolving, etc., and pull all that information together. Two, you can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems, device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, hijacks, route leaks, DNS failures, service provider outages. In other words, whatever's really going on, you can get right to the source of the problem with ThousandEyes. Three, you can take that data that you've found, those insights that you've gathered from the ThousandEyes interface, and then you can share it with vendors, with your customers. The big idea here is you can resolve your problems faster because you can say, hey, look what I found. So do you like what you hear? Good. Even better, there is a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. Sign up for a free account at www.thousandeyes.com/packetpushers, and you can choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, network intelligence you can see.
Okay, so you've got all this gear littered around the countryside. How do you react to outages? What happens if a post falls over? What happens if the power cuts out to a certain area? What happens to the network then?
For 30 minutes, not a lot. If we've had a power outage, everything that we deploy is on a UPS.
So that means every base station, every wireless access point is on a UPS as well?
It's coming back to a point in our network, which is on a UPS, you know, and it might be that that access point is taking POE at that point. Right. So yes, there's around about 30 minutes that we can operate each one of our distribution blocks for around 30 minutes with a power.
So
outage.
That covers the power. And then what about a cabling loss?
If we have a cabling loss, we're running multiple fibers. So everything that we do is dual homed. You like. Mm-hmm. If we have a catastrophic failure, and we've had an issue, you know, once last season where some of the steel shield, we had an issue with that, and both legs of the fiber were taken out as a result. Mm-hmm. In that situation, you grab your ladder, you grab your toolkit, and you take some new fiber to that location, and you bring it back online.
Do it the hard way.
You do it the hard way. If somebody's cut through your both legs of your fiber, well, they've cut through both legs of your fiber. There's not a lot you can do about that. But it's what our job is to make sure that if it happens, we manage the risk, we manage the outage.
As quickly as possible.
And, you know, touch wood, we've only had one outage like that. And the impact was one of our CCTV cameras went down for about 10 minutes. That was the only outage that we had last season.
So what do the CCTV cameras do? They just, you're watching for trouble or medical events or?
It's both. Particularly important during what we class as egress, which is, you know, once people are coming out of the arena, if you've got 20, 30, 50, 60, 70,000 people all sort of vacating, that's where the cameras come into their own. And the quality of the cameras that we deploy mean that we can get really, really close to the action. And that can be centrally controlled then from our event control setup.
Jamie, we know from talking to Ricky Cook, who does a lot of our audio engineering at Packet Pushers, that multicast can be a big deal in live sound reinforcement. So do you guys have to build out a lot of multicast in your world?
Not really, if I'm being honest. It's not something that we've actually had come on as a request. We can build that out if it's required. We do run multicast on our network in some of our networks. So it is available if needed. So I did have a request come through last year on one of our sites. This is one of my sort of geeky moments about about an audio feed that came off the main stage in one of our events. And I don't know about you, but I've never really paid a lot of attention to the data that actually flows across our network. You know, it might be transactional, financial, whatever it is. But in this particular circumstance, we were actually taking live audio feeds from the mixing desk on the main stage. And we were taking that audio and we were broadcasting it into a bar. So you could be in the bar, you could look out over the horizon, watch the main stage, and listen to the music as if you were standing in front of the stage. And we used our network as that sort of transit medium for that. And that was a multicast setup.
It's the only way you can do it, I guess. Oh, because the app was using multicast?
Yeah.
Yeah, the desk was broadcasting in multicast.
It was, yeah. So we just had to set that up.
So another nerd question. We've had a lot of techie conversation here, but this is on the context of music festivals. Are you a music fan, and have you had any brushes with greatness?
You know what? Last year, I met my two favorite rock singers. So I was very lucky to meet Corey Taylor from Slipknot last year and Justin Hawkins from The Darkness. And I've traded off that now for the last 12 months. That was a real perk for me. First event, meet your two favorite rock singers. I'm a massive music fan. You know, absolutely. I remember coming in for the interview and sitting down and sort of talking through what we'd be involved in. And I thought to myself, you know what? If I wasn't married and I didn't have children, I'd do this for free. I really was.
Did Corey Taylor scream at you just because that's what he does when he speaks normally?
No, he didn't actually. Interestingly, I briefly chatted to him, very briefly, and I asked him when he was going to do some acoustic stuff. And we were lucky enough, a friend and I were lucky enough to go and see his only acoustic show in London a few weeks ago. So that was pretty good.
I saw some video of him doing an acoustic set on YouTube and was stunned because I am so used to hearing him do the heavy style. And then it was like, this guy's got this, you know, gentle, warm voice, too. Like, I had no idea.
I was trying to come across as a bit of a sycophant or a stalker. He's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. And live acoustic performances, they really do show off his talent. Very talented guy. Hmm. My favorite song actually that he did was the Eagles' "Take It Easy." You know, imagine that Slipknot singer doing the Eagles. Fantastic! Absolutely brilliant! Absolutely brilliant! So in answer to your question, I've met a few people. Yeah, I'm a massive music fan. So I couldn't imagine working anywhere else at the moment. It's a real privilege actually. This job is a real...
Sounds like it. You've got the real, I'm loving what I'm doing and the things that you're doing. In that, I want to come back to some of the nerd stuff. In the core of that core rack that you bring in the pack, in the box, like it's on wheels and, again, I'm trying to remember the name, a carry case that it comes...
Yeah, because it comes in, we class them as flight cases.
Yeah.
They're 20, these ones are 20U in size and we rack all our kit in them.
I used to do training and I used to have a 20U flight case and the truck would deliver it and roll the wheels up and then I'd just turn it on its end and then I'd have all the gear ready to do the training. So I get that sort of an idea. We've got the power, everything's UPS'd and then it runs off to the generators.
Yep.
Did you struggle with UPS's or are generators these days gotten to the level of quality where the power is smooth and slick?
What we find is the UPS's play a huge part in stabilizing that power.
Right.
Certainly when we're out in the field. Where we are at the moment, we're on permanent power, so that's not really an issue. But it's the UPSs and their ability to actually sort of sanitize that.
It's permanent power, but it's not great quality coming off the grid, and the UPSs make it better?
They do, pretty much. Yeah, in summary, that's exactly what they do. What we do is, you know, we're quite crude with this. You know, we plug our UPSs in, we put our equipment on it, and then we take the power out, and we see whether or not it runs sufficiently for long enough. And that's pretty much what, you know, that's been our approach and it's served us well.
I don't think there's any other way to do it.
No, not really.
I guess you change the batteries in the UPSs every year or two?
Yeah, we do, yeah. That's the plan. Where we are at the moment is the UPSs are generally less than 12 months old, so we're still pretty good on that. But yeah.
One of the mistakes people make with UPSs is not changing the batteries, especially the smaller ones, because they do have a finite life. And if you're shaking them around, they last a lot less, I discovered.
Well, what we try and do is once we're in the warehouse, we build our chassis out or maybe it's already been built. We do a full test to make sure that the last thing that we need is to be
toolkit.
Hit by
a, your toolkit. Do you have a toolbox? Tell me what's in your toolbox. Is it special? Does it have like wing wangs and goose's needles?
As a set of crimps. I tend not to do that much crimping anymore. In terms of, but again, it's part of the job. My favorite piece of tech is a Fluke Link Sprinter. It's a very small version of the Fluke. It gives us wire testing. It gives us PoE. It checks that we have a connection to the switch. And it gives us some information, of course, if we're running CDP or LLDP on the network. It is my go-to piece of kit.
Well, it's very portable, very immediately useful.
I've used Flukes in the past in previous roles, and they've been big and cumbersome and over-engineered and too slow. But whatever's happened at Fluke, they've come out with this little product and it's fantastic. There's no screen on it. You use your iPhone or you use your tablet, and that'll give you the sort of the GUI. But there's some LEDs on the front that give you instant kind of results. And the one bit I do like about it is it actually puts all the data up into like a cloud solution. And then if somebody else is using it and they don't know what's happening, they can call me and I can have a look at it. So that's a great piece of kit. Other than that, it's Phillips screwdriver and a flat screwdriver, pretty much.
Some glass so you don't have a bit of Cat 5. Backpack full of esoteric instruments to make things go. You're just simple, plain, straightforward.
Old-fashioned network engineer.
I guess you don't have to spend a lot of time. It's not like you're making cables or stuff like that. You're just
there's a point where it becomes too expensive to use patch leads. It could be that the distance, from your cabinets. If you think, we go 100 meters away from the cabinet if needed with a copper connection. We're not going to make, we're not going to buy 100 meter patch leads. We're going to make on site. So that is something that we do. We do a lot of wiring.
Yeah.
And we do that deliberately to make sure that the connection's stable.
Yeah. Have you looked at modular cabling system? So you can go out and buy pre-manufactured 90 meter runs of copper, and then the things that clip on, and then the connectors at the end are just clipped on.
So I haven't. But I will do. I'm writing that down now, Greg.
Yeah. They're made by different companies, but basically, if you can imagine, is what you're hand making, you can get patch panels where you basically just get pre-made everything, and then you just snap it together however you want. You don't have to hand terminate anything or whatever.
Okay.
You can now kit out an entire data center just using modular cabling. That includes fiber and a whole bunch of stuff.
Okay. No, I'll definitely look at that. I'll definitely look into that. Thank you.
I've used it to do data. Like in the old days in data centers, what we used to do is get a guy, the people would come in and they'd run fiber optic, 25 core, 50 core, and then they'd pair back the end and then feed the cables into a tray, the fiber cores, and then they'd fusion splice them onto pigtails and all that. It's much easier if you could just get a pre-made backbone cable. And there's a connector which has got 16 cores. There's an MPO, I think called an MPO, and it's got 16 cores inside it. Fiber optic. So you clip that into a plastic frame, and lo and behold, eight fiber pairs. Done.
I shall look into that. That could save me some time.
Maybe you wouldn't use it for emergency stuff. For normal stuff, but you might use it as a backup or for special purposes.
Yes.
It's not outdoor rated, perhaps. But
okay, I'll have a look at that. Thank you.
That's why we talk to people who learn stuff. I've learned so much already. I can see why you like the Fluke Link Sprinter though. It's just brilliant because you just plug that in on a copper, and I guess there's a fiber version as well.
I think there is a fiber version. Yes, it's not something I need. In terms of what we're doing here, but certainly, if you think about, you've pulled a wiring loom in, maybe the engineer didn't label the other end properly. You put your RJ45 on it. You can find out very quickly where they plugged it in.
Yeah, it's in your environment, there's no guarantee the cable is where it is.
Of course not. Of course, it's a challenge. It's one of the biggest challenges that my boss faces as the IT manager and as he oversees the sort of the deployment, if you like, of the site. It's one of the challenges he faces is getting the case of the actual buildings, if you like, and presenting the network to them.
Right. So one of the topics that you've put on here, Jamie, is this future of mobile networking, talking a little bit about 5G and stuff. Do you see that as something that you're tracking and keeping an eye on in the team, or is it just an eye in the sky thing?
I think at the moment it's an eye in the sky thing. I think we need to be aware of it, that it's coming. We need to understand what it can give us, but we also want to understand whether or not it's a viable solution. It's okay saying that we have, you know, this amount of bandwidth in this particular spectrum, but we need to know that it will work for us. So I think as the technology evolves and as the equipment, you know, evolves, we'll be sort of looking into that to see whether or not there's anything that we can use. Again, as we've talked about our type of network, some of it's sort of campus driven, some of it's, you know, sort of directly internet driven, whether or not we can break into the internal networks through that safely. It's an interesting one, and I think it will revolutionize the mobile connectivity.
Yeah, I think 5G could be quite exciting in terms of the people at a festival, because it's designed for very high density in very small spaces, which is the very definition of a concert, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's also a design for hotspots as well, so that you can put up these mini towers. There's actually a name for them, but I just can't recall what it is right now. And they'll serve, and they originally were designed for people inside their house, if like, because the mobile phone signal couldn't penetrate into a high-rise building.
It's a pico cell.
Yeah, a pico cell or a femto cell. That's it. Now you've triggered my memory. 5G is very strong on that design. Not so much that you put them indoors, but so that carriers can put them on the top of light poles and stuff like that.
Fair enough.
And get a lot of density around the corners to get more coverage, especially in city areas, which is a very lucrative area, of course.
Absolutely.
And also 5G is very, has a number of different frequencies. Some of them are designed for broadband. Some of them are defined for handset design. Some of them are for reserve frequencies and mesh and all sort that. So the 5G isn't like just one thing. It's like a multi-purpose definition of different types of spectrum for different purposes. So there, there could be something in there, but the standard's still in development. It's not likely.
Yeah, we're still a way off, I think.
Yeah, 5 to 10 years probably, maybe faster. It depends. The demand for bandwidth is high, but more importantly, these companies have got massive investments in spectrum. Like, you know, licenses for some of the wireless spectrum run at $3 to $5 billion.
Yeah,
and so you've got to make that pay, and so 5G probably increases the revenue opportunity around reuse of that spectrum. Mm-hmm. So they're likely to do to adopt it quickly.
And I think for where I'm coming from, I think you know, it's for me it's coverage. Yeah, I've worked in organizations before where we've kind of done assessments of the mobile providers, and we look at their coverage maps. And coverage for me is an interesting word, because some organizations choose to class coverage as population coverage and others class it as geographic coverage. And there's a big difference between the two. I'd be interested to see what they class as coverage in the 5G solutions as they sort of get rolled out by the networks. You know, is coverage going to be, am I going to get great 5G in London, but I'm not going to get particularly great signal when I'm, you know, up in the Yorkshire. Or the
Glastonbury, which is in the middle of nowhere, but they still put 120,000 people on the site.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So that's where I'll be focusing my attention on. I'll be like, where is this coverage coming?
There's one part of 5G which I get interested in, which is sensors. There's a mode in 5G which is battery suitable for battery-operated sensors, and it would run 10 years on a single battery, is the calculation. Now, whether that's real or hyperbole is not sure.
Yeah, I've had in previous lives, I worked with the telemetry teams, and battery life has always been a real issue, particularly with modems and connectivity, whether that be in the 2G, 3G, 4G spectrum. So it'll be interesting to see how that revolutionizes those types of deployments once 5G comes online. So Greg, I've got a final question for you. I'd like to know the last band that you paid good money to see and what your guilty pleasure is.
My guilty pleasure is listening to female vocal trance, actually.
Okay.
usually just mixes from Mixcloud or YouTube. I listen to that a lot. Usually because that's in my earphones when I'm working and that's what I'm doing. I'm not big on seeing bands live. I've been to festivals a lot, so I used to go to 3 or 4 a year. I've been to Glastonbury 4 or 5 times, but I can't actually remember the last one I paid for, because it's been quite a long time, because I haven't been able to do that for a while. But I can tell you the last one I remember most, the festival I most remember, there was one in Henley-on-Thames, and it was all of the 80s acts. Okay. And it was like Belinda Carlisle and Rick Astley and all those people from the 80s singing three songs and then getting off stage.
It's probably about enough. Hey? Is that probably about enough?
I think the conference, it was called Reflex. I can't remember.
Rewind.
But
it's funny you should pick that. Right, my mum rang me up the other week. She says, "Oh, there's a fabulous festival. It's called Rewind. Can you get me some tickets?" So it's not one I'm involved with.
It was just great because it was like, it was very chilled. It was very relaxed. Everybody was, you know, a little bit older than some of the, and it was very, and it was just a beautiful day. And I was able to sit there and drink wine and listen to these great acts from the 80s. Everybody was revisiting their youth. It was fantastic. So that's the one I remember. What about you, Ethan?
I haven't paid good money to see anything for quite a while, although I keep looking at it. It's one of those things I never seem to find time on my calendar to go see stuff. But Montreal has things all the time. Boston has a great music scene. And it's just that it's a big deal for me to go because I live in the middle of nowhere. And so for me to go out and see live music, it's a production. So I'm just lazy and haven't made it happen. I just live in Spotify and dream.
I think there's a really good band in Boston. I think they're called the Dropkick Murphys.
Yeah. Oh, sure, yeah.
Well, I know. We went and saw that concert, the Journey cover band. We saw Journey at Cisco Live a couple of years ago.
Yeah, we did. Right. It was Journey. Yeah, it wasn't all the old members because some of them had moved on to other things. But the new singer they'd hired. And yeah, I remember that.
That was pretty good fun. But we didn't pay for that technically because it was part of Cisco Live. So I kind of didn't think about that one. But there you go. There has that.
Perfect.
That's it for this show. Thanks very much for Jamie for coming on. Please tell people where they can find you on the internet.
Okay, so I don't normally use Twitter, but we've set up an account. We are at Festival IT UK, and we'll be posting a few pictures, certainly from this event and the events that we're going to be doing through the rest of this season.
So I've got one final question for you. Can I come along and see this?
I think we can make that happen. Yeah, absolutely.
Sold. I'll come along and take photos and Twitter it out. Well, Mr. Banks, have you got any closing thoughts? I'm going to hold him to that.
So this interview was a lot of fun for me, even though I did mostly listening and less talking, because when you see these big concerts with all the oceans of people and you see the big stage with everything that's going on in the background, the video screens and the live stuff and all the music, you know, in your brain, it's like, I know there's a big network back there and I wonder what's going on. And now we know. So, yeah, I'm happy. And at the end of the day, something else interesting, Greg. Networking is still networking. There's a business problem to be solved. You got to stand up a network to deal with it. In this case, it's an outdoor environment. There's some harsher environmental concerns and different ways you design for those things since you don't have a wonderful protected building. But at the end of the day, it's still a network. Yep.
Well, yeah. That's it for the show. It's still a network. It's the same technology. You are not a precious snowflake. All right. Well, that's it for the show today. Thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. You can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts in our community, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. And follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. And last but not least, as we've probably proven today, too much networking would never be enough.